How the Dutch and the English did a merger in 1664 and laid the foundation for American pluralism and capitalism.
So if you put those two things together, this mix of different peoples and this kind of economic engine, that is a recipe not just for New York City, as it would eventually become, but for America.
That's Russell Shorto. And this is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. This week, two stories of New York, one that shaped America and one that reveals who we are right now. Russell Shorto takes us inside a forgotten turning point in history when New Amsterdam became New York in his riveting book, Taking Manhattan, the extraordinary events that created New York and shaped America. Then best-selling novelist Chris Pavone joins us to talk about his sharp, witty, and twist-filled New York novel, The Doorman, a page-turner that skewers extreme wealth, inequality, and moral compromise in contemporary life. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Historian and journalist Russell Shorto has written a book about the original Amsterdam, about New Amsterdam, and now a book about how New Amsterdam became New York. The latest book, Taking Manhattan, reveals the pivotal moment when the island city shifted from Dutch to English hands, and how that merger shaped the DNA of America by creating a multicultural society dedicated to the pursuit of profit. It was a place where more than 18 languages were spoken, even when the population was barely above 500 souls. In Taking Manhattan, Shorto shares stories of some of those who lived through this transition, including enslaved Africans, native Lenape, Jews, Christians, and early advocates of religious toleration, showing how pluralism and capitalism were baked into New York from the start. He tells us about the myth of the $24 purchase of Manhattan from the Lenape, how Dutch policies of toleration and trade seeded America's diversity, New York's role in the global slave trade, and how the divide between New York's pluralism and Boston's theocracy sowed the seeds of the ideological divide that shapes America today. Let's listen now. Russell Shorto, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, you have written a book about Dutch Manhattan, Manhattan before it was taken over by the English. But this book, Taking Manhattan, The Extraordinary Events That Created New York and Shaped America, is about that transition, what happened when the English did take over. And you write that this, the 1664 English takeover of Manhattan was, quote, an episode everybody knows about and nobody knows about. That's so true. You know, why do you think that this pivotal moment has been so overlooked?
I think people tend to think history is inevitable. You know, it's inevitable the Allies were going to win World War II. It's inevitable that the Americans would have a revolution against the English. But these things aren't inevitable. And that moment, the fact, I mean, just think, if things had not worked out the way they did, the Dutch colony, New Netherland, occupied this big chunk of the eastern seaboard, all or parts of five future states, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, parts of Pennsylvania and Delaware, with Manhattan as its capital. And the English were to the north in New England, and they had colonies to the south in Maryland and Virginia. If that had not happened, that Dutch colony would have remained. It would have continued to grow. The Dutch were a very powerful country. So all of American history would have been different. Maybe there would have been no American Revolution because it wouldn't have been 13 English colonies. You know, it would have been this whole Dutch section in the middle. So I find those sorts of things fascinating.
You open the book actually with Chief Vincent Mann of the Ramapo Lenape Nation. So of course, Native America was such a critical part of this history and also a part that is at least equally hidden to us. Why did you choose to begin there, and how does that frame the story that you tell about Manhattan's twin takings by colonial powers?
Well, right, that's it, because what the book mostly focuses on is what I call the second taking, which is when the English took it from the Dutch. But 40 years earlier, the Dutch had taken it from the native people. And that remains a part of the story at the time of the showdown between the English and the Dutch. The native people were very much a presence. So I also, within the book, I tell that story of how the infamous story is that the Dutch, quote, bought the island of Manhattan for $24. And in there is the idea of this gargantuan swindle, and kind of makes it seem like the native people are just fools. In fact, it was much more complicated and fascinating event where the Dutch understood perfectly well the native people did not have a concept of real estate and as something you can just buy and sell. What the Dutch wanted to do was to get a piece of paper, a deed, so they could show other Europeans, look, we have this property. But they also entered into the kind of treaty that the native people were used to, where what you were doing was entering an alliance. So they were saying, you can come and live on this island and we'll trade with each other. The native people wanted European manufactured goods and we'll continue to use it too. So it was more like a joint use agreement. And the $24 comes from, there were goods, there were gifts given. And those gifts, somebody valued at 60 guilders in the 17th century, which then in the 19th century got converted to dollars.
Now, the Ramapo Lenape Nation is still around today. Tell us a little bit about the perspective of Chief Vincent Mann on this history. What did he tell you?
Yeah, so you asked me why I opened the book with an interview with a Lenape leader. For one thing, to show they're still here. We have this, Americans, I think, tend to have this notion that those people are of the past, you know, whether it's the Lenape or other nations. In fact, New York City today has more Native American residents within New York City than any reservation in the country. There are 180,000 Native Americans living in New York City. So what happened to the Lenape? I tell that story a bit near the end of the book. Of like other tribes and nations elsewhere, they got pushed aside, they got swindled out of land, they were pushed into reservations. The Lenape they're further west. They are, some are in Ontario and Canada, and the Ramapo are right across the Hudson River from Manhattan in New Jersey. So from there, from where I interviewed Chief Mann, you can almost see the skyline of Manhattan, not quite, but almost. And I just thought that was such an outrageous irony that here they are. And Chief Mann's wife told me in that interview, you know, we're still here only 30 or 40 miles from where we were all those years ago. And Chief Mann was very eloquent, and he talked for a couple of hours to me about what his people have endured over the centuries and how they have fought in court often to maintain their presence.
So that was some important new information. How well known are those stories before you got to them? And also talk a little bit about some of the newly translated Dutch records. Those are the ones that you refer to, right? How they changed or deepened your understanding of what happened.
The Ramapo Lenape story is a really complicated one. It has been told in different ways. New Jersey newspapers have covered them over the years. In the 90s, they had a court battle. They wanted to apply for federal recognition, and it was blocked in part by Donald Trump, who at the time thought that they would probably then start a casino which would compete with his casinos in Atlantic City. So, you know, their story has a lot of twists and turns to it. As to the Dutch documents, as I said, it occurred to me that the most recently translated documents, which are from 1663, 64, so the last couple of years in the life of the colony, right before the English took over, they're very rich, they're very full because New Amsterdam had become The background of the story is that the Dutch in the 17th century pioneered two things: religious toleration, which was unusual in Europe at the time. What was typical was intolerance. That was official policy because people thought it's a dangerous world and we all have to be on the same page and religion is a divisive force. So we have to have a state religion. We have to keep out others. The Dutch more or less flew in the face of that. They created this official policy of religious toleration, which was limited. For one thing, in the Dutch colony, their toleration didn't extend to the native people who they were busy trying to dislocate. They also inaugurated the slave trade in New York. So you have to note that it was truly a limited thing. On the other hand, it was a watershed. At a time when others in Europe were bent on intolerance, they had this policy of toleration, which then that allows for a pluralistic society, this multi-ethnic society, people speaking different languages and worshiping different faiths. And that then gets seated on Manhattan. And at the same time, the Dutch in Europe pioneered what we would call capitalism, although the word wouldn't come into being for a couple of centuries. So if you put those two things together, this mix of different peoples and this kind of economic engine, that is a recipe not just for New York City, as it would eventually become, but for America.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with historian and journalist Russell Shorto about his new book, Taking Manhattan: The Extraordinary Events That Created New York and Shaped America. You say that there are how many languages? Something like, was it 17?
The famous statistic in 1643 was quoted that there were 18 languages being spoken in New Amsterdam, and that was at a time when there were probably only about 500 people there. So, as I've said before, New York was New York even before it was New York.
Yeah, and that doesn't even count the Native American languages.
Or probably there were at least three different African languages being spoken.
So talk more about that very early New York, what it was like, you know, how were the relationships between the Native Americans in Manhattan? I mean, I have this big, wonderful book called Manahatta, which I think was the original name of the island, which shows a very beautiful place before it was all taken over. Talk a little bit about those early relationships between people, how it made a pluralistic society.
So as we're just talking now, when the Dutch came, Dutch meaning it was under Dutch auspices, but it was a mixed community pretty much from the start. In fact, the first settlers, many of them were French speaking. So it was this mixed community of Europeans. And they came largely to do business with the native people. So the idea was not, let's exterminate these people or let's push them out. They were interested in furs, particularly beaver pelts. And the Europeans were not trappers. The idea was they would trade with the native people who trapped the furs. And then the native people in exchange would get things like knives and kettles and pots and pans and things that they valued. And for much of the life of the colony, that was the case. There were also several instances where skirmishes broke out, and in some cases, the skirmishes turned into wars, and it got ugly, and there was massacres. So in this 40-year period, you have to kind of picture all of that. There were periods of ugliness. At the same time, for much of the life of the colony, it was trade. There were native people coming in and out of New Amsterdam and also Beverwijk, which was the second city up to the north, which later became Albany under the English. Native people would come into town. They would, you know, buy bread at the bakers. These were really, in terms of the ethnic mix of people, they were really interesting places. New Amsterdam had many different languages spoken, and all of these people, they were there also because they were traders, not just to trade with the natives, but with other parts of the world. So New York Harbor is, of course, this world-class port, and they were there as well to trade with the English colonies in New England, with colonies that were set up in the Caribbean, in South America, in different parts of Western Europe, with West Africa. It's this vital node on this vast Atlantic circuit.
And you tell some of the stories of individual people, intimate personal stories about some of those who were there at this time of what would be a great transition. Just give us a little flavor, pick out a couple of characters to tell us about.
Sure. There was a small Jewish community in New Amsterdam, and it had a leader whose name was Asser Levy, and I spent some time with him. So you have this policy of tolerance or toleration. On the other hand, as in any time, as in America right now, for example, you have leaders who are very happy to violate the very principles that the place was founded on. So Peter Stuyvesant, as the leader, was actually, even though he was a leader of a colony that had this government in the home country that had a policy of toleration of religious differences, he himself believed that in order to be strong, his little community should be on the same page. And he, in particular, thought, as did most European Christians at the time, that the Jews were, as he called them, a deceitful race. He didn't want Jews to settle. He tried to bar them. They appealed over his head, and Asser Levy led the appeal, and he was forced to allow them to stay. So Asser Levy is this interesting figure who appoints himself the head of this community of 24 people, and he's in court on their behalf several times to force the government in Manhattan to abide by the laws of the home country. Another person I focus on is a woman named Dorothea Angola, who, as her name sounds like, was African. She arrived with, I think probably with the first group of enslaved Africans in 1627, just a year after New Amsterdam was founded. This was a group of 22 people. She was probably a teenager at the time, spent then the whole rest of her life on Manhattan. She was enslaved. She married another enslaved African. They had children. And then because slavery was not an official institution, people petitioned for their rights. And many of the enslaved, after a number of years, petitioned for their freedom, arguing that they had basically done enough. And in every case that we know of, they were granted their freedom. So Dorothea and her husband get their freedom, and they're given land, 6 acres of land, a couple miles north of New Amsterdam. Her husband dies, they have children, she remarries, and she has children, eventually grandchildren. They're all living on this big 6-acre plot. And when I looked to compare that with the modern map of Manhattan, I realized she owned Greenwich Village. That was her home. So she then, when at this moment when the English are coming and there's this showdown between the English and the Dutch, she at that point is a free landowner and this matriarch of quite a community of people. And all of the, you know, the story I tell of the takeover is the whole community of New Amsterdam was involved in this drama that played out over the course of weeks, where the English are threatening to invade and the Dutch want to repel them. And they're passing, they have negotiators going back and forth through the harbor. And Dorothy Angola and Asser Levy and others who I focus on are very much part of this whole drama.
Now let's talk about the story of two of the principals of this transition, Richard Nichols, the English, quote, invader. And you've already said a little bit about Peter Stuyvesant, but tell us more about him and their relationship with each other.
Stuyvesant was the leader of the Dutch colony for its last 17 years. He was a very capable leader. He had, as I said, his very strong opinions. I think he, more than any one person, fashioned it into this successful trading port that would then become New York under the English. And he very much wanted to keep it. His part of his job was to not let any other power take over. Richard Nichols had been sent by the the king, Charles II, and his brother James, the Duke of York, to take it from the Dutch. The backstory to that is, in England, throughout the whole 17th century, you have the Civil War taking place. You have this strife, which then leads to civil war. And the strife is between the Puritans, who were these theocrats, this kind of religious cult, I would think, that wanted to transform all of English society into a theocracy. And then you have the royalists who supported the king, who really were, more than anything else, anti-Puritans. So they were all different types, but they were united in not wanting the Puritans to take over and make it a theocracy. The Puritans did take over. They beheaded the Charles I, the king. They ruled for 8 years. Then Charles, his son, becomes Charles II, and he and his brother James take over, and they now want to remake the country, and most of all, they want to start to catch up to the Dutch, who have this global empire. So they want to begin to build the British Empire. And they look across the Atlantic, and they see the American colonies. They see New England, which is English, and they see settlements to the south in Virginia and Maryland, and they see this whole chunk in the middle, which their arch rivals, the Dutch, have. So they send Richard Nichols, this trusted soldier who they've known. They happened, in researching him for the book, I discovered that they had known him. They'd grown up together. They'd known him their whole lives. So they trust him, and they send him on this very complicated mission. And it's complicated because how he's going to do this. I mean, he comes with ships and soldiers and weapons, so it's assumed he's going to have to fight for it. The king and his brother, the Duke of York, want this real estate. But Richard Nichols, once he gets this assignment, starts to do his homework about this Dutch colony. And he recognizes that it is something very special, not just the geography, that the Dutch have built this, you know, and this goes back to my, these Dutch documents and how they reveal this complicated, vibrant community. What is it that makes it tick? He starts to unpack that and to realize, well, they've got this mixed community of people who speak different languages, who are able to communicate with these different settlements elsewhere in the world. And they've got this economic engine that allows them to make risky ventures less risky, like voyages to faraway places. So he comes to decide that if at all possible, he wants to take the place not by force. He wants to keep this population. So that then becomes, he sails into the harbor, and for 2 weeks, they are pointing their guns at one another and they're talking. And Nichols wants to take the place peacefully. Stuyvesant doesn't want to give up the place because that's his job is to keep it. But from the Dutch perspective, Stuyvesant and all the other people in Manhattan have long known that the Dutch government, the Dutch in Europe, are not willing to really support them. Their attention is elsewhere. It's on the so-called East Indies, where they've gotten their wealth from Asia. It's on the Caribbean. They have appealed many times to be supported, and they just don't get anywhere. So they know they're on their own. So this then sets up the situation for this negotiation. And I think the hardest part in the negotiation, which is really the part of the book, the person who has the hardest decision is Stuyvesant, because he has to be loyal to the West India Company, which oversees the colony, and to the Dutch government. But ultimately, since they are not supporting him, he decides that his greatest loyalty is to this community that he helped build, these people on the ground. And he comes to conclude that if he can get from Nichols enough promises that they'll get to keep their homes, their businesses, their trade networks, then that will be the best thing for him, to give it over to the English. And that's what they work out. They work out the agreement is very much like a Bill of Rights, in which the English promise you will keep your homes, you'll keep your Dutch ships coming in and out, you'll keep your trade networks, and you'll have a voice in government. And so that is this, what I call it in the book, a merger, this deal that results in a place that Richard Nichols himself decides to call New York. And to me, that is this remarkable story of New York's founding, in that it is a story of, it's a business negotiation. And New York is the home of, business negotiations. And it was founded on, it's a mergers and acquisitions deal.
So say a little bit more about the Dutch West India Company, because I think that this is really critical. And talk about, you know, what happened to its influence. I mean, now it was no longer in charge of New York. How did that transition change the history of that, you know, gymungous company?
So this deal, this merger, was in fact good for the people in New Amsterdam, the people in the colony of New Netherland. It meant that they were going to be part of this growing English empire, and they stayed part of the Dutch trading empire too. So that helps to give New York in its earliest days this real boost. The Dutch West India Company was a big loser, as was the Dutch government. Peter Stuyvesant was recalled back to the home country after this, to stand trial for giving this up. He spent about 2 years. He brought all these documents and affidavits and things to support his cause, because in fact he had violated his employment contract, I guess you'd say. Nevertheless, he was ultimately exonerated. And the most interesting thing about him of all is that after 2 years of defending himself and then finally he's freed, what does he do? He goes back to New York and lives out his days there, which shows you that his loyalty truly was to that place that he had helped build. The Dutch West India Company, you ask about their fortunes. The Dutch East India Company was founded earlier, and that's what they did, the colonizing and exploitation in the East Indies, that is in Asia, Japan, what's now Indonesia, bringing this massive wealth in the form of spices and silks and things like that. And that really becomes the driver of the Dutch economy that allows it to just explode. They tried to do the same thing with the founding a Dutch West India Company in what they call the West Indies, meaning the Atlantic Rim, and it never turned a profit. So finally, after failing at several other ventures, the West India Company says, okay, let's go big on slavery. So they become the main Dutch force behind the slave trade, and they never turned a profit at that, although they brought misery to millions of people. And then in 1672... that's the beginning of the end for the Dutch Empire, whereas the English Empire, the British Empire, is going to, of course, get stronger and stronger.
Now, as I'm talking with you, Russell Shorto, about your book, Taking Manhattan, The Extraordinary Events That Created New York and Shaped America, we have just seen a primary election in New York City where an immigrant has won the Democratic nomination. He's a democratic socialist. Your book pretty clearly, firmly puts New York as, a critical focus point for capitalism, imperialism, and slavery. And yet one could argue that it is that same pluralism that had a critical part to play in the election of Zoran Mamdani. So just to span the centuries here, what is your reaction to this? What is your thought on this, especially at a time where the federal government is headed by a man and a group of people who want to destroy pluralism?
So I make this point near the end of the book that what I didn't mention earlier when I was talking about Richard Nichols and him being sent on this mission, he was actually sent on two missions. One was to take this colony from the Dutch. The other was, the other concern, New England. England, you know, so here's the royals coming back into power in England. And they, when they look across the Atlantic, they see, okay, there are these New England colonies that have been there for several decades, but they were founded by the Puritans. And they were still Puritan strongholds. And the Puritans were the other side. They were still the enemy. They were the people who had cut off the heads of the king and his brother. So what to do about them? They were defiant of the Stuart government, of the monarchy, because that in under English law, the king was the head of the Church of England. And the Puritans' mission in life was to purify the Church of England of corruption. And that meant the monarchy. So Richard Nichols' second mission was to go to Boston, the center of Puritan leadership, and make the Puritans bow down to the monarchy, ideally to sweep out their influence and you know, establish a broader influence, English influence. And the Stuarts, the king, their party wanted religious toleration, so that which helped in the negotiations with the Dutch, because they in certain ways they saw eye to eye. Richard Nichols succeeded in his first mission. He got the Dutch colony, and it became, because of its Dutch underpinnings, this center of pluralism that New York has been ever since, and that we see beautifully manifested in the primary win by Mamdani. He failed utterly in his mission to the Puritans in Boston. They were too powerful. They said, get lost. And Boston then became this center of a very different ideology. So Nichols' two missions result, if you look in this long sweep, which you're inviting me to do, in two very different ideological centers establishing themselves in American history. New York is tolerant, multi-ethnic, globally minded, business-minded, and the one based in Boston, which, you know, the geography changes. Boston is no longer a center of Puritanism, but that establishes in America this ideology of America first, of, you know, we're a Christian nation. And those two things are very much at odds. I think that they are, both of them, remain part of American history. In every single chapter of American history, you see elements of those two things. And what's going on right now, what just happened in New York, and what's happening in America in the Trump era, are, we see, living out. These two ideologies are still at it, still at war.
Well, that is just a fascinating overview. You know, it's so interesting how contemporary people are unaware of the long tail of critical moments in history. Is this something that you've also noticed before, or did this book really kind of bring that into relief for you?
What I just sketched out, this book really brought into relief. And it's true that critical events, and especially formative events, because it's kind of like DNA, you know, it's like an acorn and an oak tree. You know, the New Amsterdam was this tiny little settlement, but it grows into this oak tree of New York. And you would look at the two and say, what does the one have to do with the other? Well, it's that genetic material, and that means something. And that's what gives nations a kind of through line, their character somehow remains, even with all these changes that take place.
Hmm. Well, your book, Taking Manhattan, is a wonderful guide to those, as the subtitle says, extraordinary events that created New York and shaped America. Russell Shorto, it's been fascinating to talk with you about this book. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Francesca. It's been wonderful.
Russell Shorto is the best-selling author of 8 books, including Small Time, Revolution Song, Amsterdam, and The Island at the Center of the World. He's the director of the New Amsterdam Project at the New York Historical Society and senior scholar at the New Netherland Institute. Next up, another New York story, this time in the present day. Stay tuned after the break. Thank you. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. We turn now to a contemporary story about New York, a propulsive upstairs-downstairs tale of the new Gilded Age. It's a thriller laced with biting social commentary on wealth inequality and the price of ambition. Novelist Chris Pavone takes us to a luxury building on the Upper West Side in The Doorman, where we meet three central characters: Chicky, the loyal but debt-burdened doorman; Emily, an art world insider married to obscene wealth; and Julian, a cultural gatekeeper questioning his relevance. Pavone explores class inequality, performative liberalism, and the illusion of choice with a plot full of twists. Chris Pavone, welcome to Writer's Voice.
So good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I hugely enjoyed this novel. It's a savage critique of our current extreme wealth inequalities, but an incredibly funny one, written with compelling characters and a very twisty plot. There's practically nobody who escapes a scalpel that dissects our contemporary dysfunction. I was kind of put in mind of Bonfire of the Vanities, but I think the situation has gotten even ever more extreme than that era. Tell us a little bit about just how you approached that aspect of this novel. You know, why did you write this novel with so much critique of, in such detail, of our contemporary life?
Well, I was inspired by Bonfire of the Vanities, actually. I read that book when it was a new book 40 years ago, and I remember it being spectacular. And a book that introduced me, even though I grew up in New York City and I lived in New York City at the time, and I still do, introduced me to all sorts of corners of the city that I would otherwise not have had access to. And it invented a whole new lexicon in talking about wealth. And also, Tom Wolfe skewered absolutely everybody in that book. And as the years have gone by, and I revisited it once 5 years ago, it doesn't hold up all that well in a lot of ways. And it's a book about racism that is arguably maybe a racist book itself. And I decided that I wanted to write a New York novel that was also about the things that Bonfire was about race and class and money and ambition and marriage and sex and adultery and crime and murder and exploitation, but to do it all from a contemporary lens and I would say a more sympathetic way of looking at all the characters.
At all the characters, well, I'm not sure all of them, but certainly the protagonists. You root this story in three protagonists. First, of course, is the doorman for the building. This is a building that you call the Bohemia, which kind of reminded me of the Dakota. You actually based that character on a doorman in a building where you live, although not his story.
Yeah.
Start out by telling us a little bit about the real doorman as an homage, and then tell us about your protagonist, Chicky.
Well, the real doorman was one of the first people we met in our building when we moved in 5.5 years ago. And his name was Johnny, and he worked daytime days. And I saw this guy every day, and he was a very friendly, warm, engaging guy who was always happy to greet not only everybody who lived in the building, but everybody who lived in the neighborhood, and their kids and their dogs and the tourists and anybody walking by. He had just this incredible warmth that you could practically feel from across the street. And I used to talk to him every day, once in the morning when I was leaving, once in the afternoon coming back. And at first, we talked about typical just chit-chat stuff. We talked about the weather and the New York Mets and the New York Yankees and his softball team and my bad knees and the types of things that people talk about for a couple of minutes at a time every day. And then Johnny got sick and he got a bad diagnosis and he left and did not come back to work for, I think, 9 months. And he spent most of that time in the hospital. And as soon as he was able, all he wanted to do was come back to work. And when he returned to work, he had 6 months to live. It turned out that he lived for another 2 years, but he was under no impression that he was not going to die from this cancer. And he came to work every day and continued to hail cabs and hold doors and carry bags and chit chat with everybody while also definitely dying. And where we used to talk about shallow things, now we were talking about God and dying and the meaning of life and what it means to be a parent. And this was a very meaningful interaction that I had with this guy, and I hope that he had with me. And one day at the end of his shift, somebody else, another doorman, asked him how he was feeling. And he said, "I'm so tired, man." And he left work and he went home and he died. And he had plenty of time to think about what would happen after he died. And what he chose to do for his memorial service was have it be 2 blocks from this building where he worked, so that the people he worked for could come to his memorial service more easily than the people he lived among. And he was buried in his full doorman uniform, complete with a cap on. The only non-regulation item was a New York Mets pin on his necktie. And that pin absolutely broke my heart. And the entire thing, the entire Johnny, broke my heart. And I was already well in the way into writing this book when he died. And none of the character, none of his life is based on Johnny's life, but his personality was very much based on this real life guy.
That's actually very moving, because I think in this novel, Chicky just so brilliantly brings to life the struggles of the people who are not the wealthy, you know, in the society. I mean, he has a good job, but he is really burdened by incredible debt, medical debt. I mean, just the things that happen to so many people who don't have the cushion that the people that he worked for do. And it's something, you know, this wonderful guy is just really being crushed by that. Tell us a little bit more about Chicky.
Chicky has only ever worked this job in his life, except for in his youth, he was in the Marines. And he was in the Marines not because of any particular burning desire to serve his country, but simply because his father pushed him into it. And he couldn't think of anything better to do when he was 19 years old. And I think a lot of people fall into a lot of things for exactly this reason, not intentionally, but just because it's the thing that's put in front of them and it's the thing that's available. And that's something that is a theme throughout this novel, that the thing that's put in front of Chicky is the Marines and then working in a building on staff. And the thing that's put in front of Emily, a different character, is a career in art and then an opportunity to marry an incredibly rich man. And the thing that's put in front of the rich man is the opportunity to get even richer by being essentially a profiteer. And I think that we are all of us, a victim. We owe a lot of what we have in life based on circumstances of our birth. And that obviously some people rise above it or think well below it. But for so many of us, we are simply put on the path by our parents, by the circumstances of our birth and our upbringing. And it's very rare that people end up really diverting tremendously from those paths. And in my building where I work, most of the guys who work there because they knew somebody who worked there, and that's how they got the job. And this is, again, not that intentional of a thing, just something that happens when you're 19, 20, 21 years old, when people somehow make important decisions about what they're going to do with their whole lives when they're essentially children. And it becomes very hard to decide at some point in life not to do that thing anymore. And all of the characters in this book essentially were put on a path when they were that age, and they all never really decided to do something different.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit more about Emily, because what struck me is that Chicky, Emily, and then the third character, which I'd also like you to say a little bit about, is Julian Sonnenberg. They three are really sympathetic characters. You like them. They struggle with life. They struggle with making the right decisions. They try to be moral in their lives. But they really stand out against so many of the other characters who have none of those ethical compunctions.
Emily went out into the world, as some people do, without really feeling the extreme need to earn a living, because her parents are relatively well off and she was relatively well educated. And even though there were times when she was having trouble making her monthly expenses, she was never a person who was worried about being homeless or not having enough to eat or not having the money to pay for healthcare that she needed. And in that way, it's relatively easy to be this type of, now, I wouldn't say poor, but this type of broke. You have no money, but you also are not actually poor. And she lived this way, as a lot of people do, especially in New York City throughout her 20s. And it was increasingly not that satisfying of an experience. And then she found herself in this position of being pursued by an incredibly wealthy man who she also realized might be not the greatest guy in the world. But here she was with this choice put in front of her. You can become an extremely rich person with the ability to do anything and not just live anywhere you want, and not just decorate your home any way you want or send your children to the finest schools, but actually help the world in whatever way you want and help people who would otherwise not be helped because you have the resources to help them, and to build wings on museums, and to donate money to charities, and to spend your days working to help the less fortunate. That is one of the choices that you have if you are a person like Emily and you choose to marry somebody with hundreds of millions of dollars or more. And one of the things that I want readers to take away from this book is to try to put yourself into this position and ask yourself, here you are, what would you do? And I think it's very hard to argue that you would not do exactly what Emily has done. And she married this guy, and it turned out, as a lot of things turn out, when you ask yourself, how bad can it be? Well, it can actually be worse than you were imagining. And that's the situation she finds herself in, married to somebody who she now considers to be a villain, who behaves in a lot of ways that are villainous. But she also can't bring herself to leave him because of the lifestyle and the financial hardships, I guess is not the right word, but sacrifices that it would entail to leave him.
And when you say hardships, I mean, she squirrels away some $25 million. When she realizes that, you know, at some point she may need to leave, she has a prenup, which would give her $900,000 a year, which at one point she says, well, it's only 1% of his wealth, you know, of the wealth that they have. I wonder if you could just say something about this phenomenon, which I have read about, that at each tier of wealth, the people who are just below the ones who are above them feel that they are impoverished compared to those who are above them. And when you're talking about billionaires, this just gets actually quite bizarre. Talk a little bit about how you portray this, you know, the 0.1% of the top 1%.
I think one of the things we've learned about happiness through surveys over the past few decades is that the most important contributor to individual happiness isn't your overall degree of anything, but simply how much you have of everything compared to the people around you. And whether that's money or something else, the most important thing that makes people happy or not happy is their relationship to the people who are around them. And if you have $1 billion and everybody you know has $50 billion, you are almost by definition unhappy. And maybe that speaks to ways in which people should choose their friends in a different way. But regardless of what people do about it, that's a situation that I think we are all in. And that's a situation that Emily is in. And she is not unhappy because of the amount of money she has. She is worried about giving up most of that money, the lion's share of that money. That said, I think she, over the course of this novel, which takes place largely in one day, has come to the conclusion that I don't want to spoil the plot about here, But this is part of her evolution over the course of this story, how she looks at that money and what she can live with and what she can't live with.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Chris Pavone about his new novel, The Doorman. It's a darkly funny, razor-sharp portrait of money, ambition, and moral ambiguity in today's New York. And without giving too much away, there is a love story here, and I think very much she's faced with a kind of decision between love and keeping up the level of wealth that she's used to. Tell us about Julian Sonnenberg.
I think Julian is one of many characters in this book, or one of almost all the characters in this book, who is struggling with what it means right now to be liberal in America. And I think that that's one of the inspirations for me in writing this book, is I live a life surrounded by people who think of themselves as progressive, and I'm one of those people, and people who would not dream of voting for anybody who wasn't a Democrat. But in the past few years, I have noticed a very, very marked difference in what a lot of people on the left consider to be the appropriate way to be on the left, and the appropriate books to read, and the appropriate stances to take. And I feel like a lot of what I have always thought of as the liberal half of America has become increasingly illiberal and demanding of a consistency of thought and belief and action that is actually the opposite of what it means to be liberal. And Julian has lived his whole life in a way that he thinks of as liberal, as progressive, as very racially sensitive, as somebody who set forth in his career in the art world to specifically uplift the careers and the voices and the fortunes of people of color. And he now finds himself in middle age, possibly being disposed of for the very thing that he set out to do, was to make himself sort of irrelevant. And now he has possibly become irrelevant. And he's struggling with what it is that he's going to do with the rest of his life, now that maybe the mission that he set for himself has gotten so far that it no longer needs him. And he's struggling, as Emily is, as a few other characters are what it means in this moment to be liberal, and what it is that you are trying to accomplish for other people versus what you're trying to communicate about yourself, and what you do about it when you and the people around you disagree about what it means to be a liberal.
Yeah, I struggled with aspects of this in your book because I think you pose a very important question, but it's quite complicated. And that is, how do you draw the line between a kind of performative progressivism, or what the right calls woke? And I have problems with the way the right talks about woke. You know, how you draw the line between performative and actually trying to undo some of the terrible things that have been done in American history, how to set a different way, how to express solidarity with people who have been marginalized, who have been put down. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about this. I mean, I remember when the word woke first came about, and it came about from the left. And I like the idea of being awake to the needs of other people, or being awake to historic wrongs. And then the whole term woke got changed. And I wondered at times whether you were, you know, where do you draw that line between what is a genuine desire to create solidarity and what is just performative and actually exclusionary or illiberal, as you say?
Well, I think it's up to all of us where we draw that line. My line is not in this book. I'm not one of the characters in this book. And I feel like that's an important thing to point out here. What I'm trying to do in this novel is represent a variety of points of view along the political spectrum that are all representative of the types of people who I think dominate discourse in New York City right now. And that is why those points of view are there. And That's why their commentary is there. It's none of it is my commentary, and that's why some of it conflicts with things. That there, Emily has a very specific point of view. Julian has a very specific point of view. Chicky, the doorman, also has his own very specific point of view on these things. And Emily's villainous husband, Wit, has a completely different point of view. I don't think that any of those points of view is more or less valid than the others. That's, I'm not trying to weigh in on the value of people's opinions about how we go forth into this world. That is not something that I feel like is my mission. I'm just trying to present the types of people who are indicative of our culture right now and put them into conflict with each other about these opinions.
And yet you did just say that you feel that the left has gotten to be illiberal. What do you mean by that, actually? What do you mean by the left has become illiberal, or parts of it have?
Well, I think liberal, the idea of liberal, is being welcoming to all thought. And I think that right now the left in America is not welcoming to all thought, specifically not welcoming to anybody who disagrees. And I think that that's something that the left, a moral high ground that the left has sacrificed. And by the way, I'm on the left. I'm not disavowing being on the left. I'm suggesting that one of the reasons I think we find ourselves in the predicament that we right now find ourselves in with today, the passage of Trump's one big horrible bill, is exactly because too much of the left has become too intolerable of people who don't agree with them. And that has driven people away and driven people into the arms of disaster.
Yeah, just before we came on this this call, I was reading an article by someone who has been on Writer's Voice before, Eric Blanc, who's on his Substack, where he writes about Zohran Mamdani. And he talks about how he threads that needle, that he says he refused to drop his support for democratic socialism or his opposition to Zionist apartheid, but performative ultra-leftism was anathema to this campaign. And Mamdani has said over and over again that he wants to talk with people who disagree with him. And it's so striking that he achieved a landslide against Cuomo, I think very much by that kind of openness. Part of it was that. What's your thought on that?
My thought is that type of candidacy, that the political campaign that's just sort of ended in New York, is exactly the type of thing that I wanted to write a novel that included aspects of. That this city is a very complicated place politically with a lot of different interests and a lot of different interests that revolve around not just what we consider to be politics, but also religion, and simply class or ethnic or religious affiliations. And that's a big part of this novel as well, as it was a big part of Bonfire of the Vanities. I think it's one of the interesting things about New York City. And I think one of the things that I've been drawn to always in reading books that are I consider to be New York novels, which are books about all these issues that encompass our city every day, is that it's also a great New York City novel that's about all these issues. It's also a novel that's about all the issues that consume America as a whole. And I think there are a lot of places in America where people can live lives in silos, in isolation, where they only see people who agree with them, where they only see people who look like them. And whether that is in a poor rural part of an agrarian state, or whether it's in a gated community in Beverly Hills, there are plenty of ways to exist in this country without rubbing elbows with people who disagree with you or don't look like you or who don't worship the way you do. But we can't do that in New York City. There's no such thing as a gated community. And there's no such thing as a community that's politically homogenous. And I think that's one of the things that makes New York City novels so compelling to me as a reader and why I wanted to write one.
Yeah, I felt that this book, Chris Pavone, The Doorman, was a kind of love letter to New York. I reveled in your descriptions of the city and different parts of it. It's a character in this novel itself.
I consider myself to be a very visual and sensory writer, that it's very important to me in every book of mine, and this one as much as the others, to give people a real sense of where they are, of what the characters are seeing and maybe even smelling or tasting, feeling. It's one of the things that I want people to be able to do as a reader, is to see the things that are around them in every scene, to have a very clear visual idea of what this apartment is that I'm looking at, what this neighborhood is, what Central Park looks like or feels like or sounds like in the dark. And that's something that I try to accomplish in really every page of writing, is to make sure that the reader can put themselves into that sensory environment. And New York is where I've lived really my whole life, and it's a very natural place for me to write about. And also, I began to write this book at the beginning of COVID, when we weren't going anywhere. So I was sort of forced to write a New York novel. But I've been meaning to write a New York novel since well before I was even a novelist. I've always read those types of books, and I've always wanted to write one. It is a city that I love, and not just because of the things that I think are great about it, but because of the things that I think are awful about it. It's a big jumble of positive and negative and everything in between.
And what, other than, say, Bonfire of the Vanities, what are some other New York novels that you like especially?
Oh, my God, so many of them. The John Dos Passos books of the early 20th century, and Invisible Man, and Jazz, and almost everything written by Jonathan Lethem. I just did a panel a couple of weeks ago with two people who wrote some of my favorite New York novels of the past few years. One is Jenny Jackson, whose book about called Pineapple Street addresses many of the same themes that I tackle in The Doorman, and Ruman Alam, whose most recent book was Entitlement. The book before that was A Home at the End of the World? No, what was I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name. It was made into a movie starring Julia Roberts. But in any case, Entitlement is really the New York book. But both of these books are very much about race and class and money and ambition. And it was a great panel.
Oh, that's great. Finally, I just want to talk a little bit about how you structure this novel, because it's quite intricate. It's almost as if you slowly unpeel the layers of the onion of the plot. You know, there's a little hint, a little setup, and then you drop it. And then, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 pages later and several chapters, then you pick it up again and it goes a little bit deeper. Just talk a little bit about your writing process in the plot, of how you keep these pieces together and allow that slow tease to occur.
I feel like it's my job as somebody who considers himself to be a suspense novelist to first and foremost to always be focusing on how to generate suspense. And to me, suspense is very reliant, as everything else is in a novel, on character. That if you don't care about the characters, if you're not invested in them, then you don't care what happens to them. And there's no real such thing as suspense if you don't care what happens to the people in the story. But to me, a very large part of generating suspense is to pose questions that are not explicit, that the reader doesn't recognize they're reading a question, but is nevertheless a statement that's incomplete, with facts withheld, with something that you feel as a reader you are not getting the full story, and you need to continue to turn pages in order to get that story. And it's something that I try to do really on almost every page, a task I set to myself of constantly generating questions and withholding answers. And in this book, a large part of the questions and the answers have to do with the relationships among these characters, which you don't know what they are for the first half of the book. And then there's a fairly large paradigm shift when there's a moment of clarity, when you understand that a relationship isn't exactly what it looked like. And then there are another couple of twists at the end when some of that is again turned on its head. And what I've been trying to do the whole time is to make readers wonder what exactly is going on here. And I think that the question of what exactly is going on here, to me, as a reader, is often much more compelling than what's going to happen. What's going to happen, which is the basis of most thrillers, and what happened in the past tense, which is the basis of most mysteries, I think both of those are compelling questions also. And I try to have some of those in the book too. But also this question of what the hell is going on at this moment is something that I hope to be able to do without leaving readers confused or upset about it, but simply wondering what's going on. I know as a reader, I know that everything on this page is not exactly what it appears to be, and I want to find out.
Well, you really succeeded that. It was really terrific. Had me, it's what the publicists like to call propulsive.
Yeah.
It moved me from page to page. Well, Chris Pavone, I hugely enjoyed reading The Doorman, as I have hugely enjoyed talking with you. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been interesting.
You can read an excerpt from The Doorman by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.